I think someone in the cast was like, "Oh, that was like that was like our Imogen Poots song," and I was like, "Our Imogen Poots, Imogen Heap, Imogen Poots is the actress." Yes, our like Imogen Heap moment. Hello, everyone, and welcome to Plot Devices, episode 53, movie reviews and film news. My name is Brandon King. I am your host for today. Thank you so much for being here. If you have not followed us, Spotify, Apple Podcasts, RSS feed, you should be listening on one of those platforms. Give the show a follow if you haven't. Give us a rating if you can. Comment if it's available to you. And if you can't comment on the show yourself, we are on social media, Twitter for the time being, Instagram, and eventually Blue Sky at Plot Devices Pod. Let us know how we're doing and what you want to see over there. All those social media links will be in the description below. Speaking of comments, the discussion question we launched last week, what is your favorite DreamWorks movie? For this week, the discussion question leaning towards one of our topics for today, what's your favorite adaptation of Frankenstein that isn't the original novel? So that can be any film, TV show, web series, play. I know there was just an opera take at Phoenix Opera just in like the last year or so that's possible. What is your favorite take on Frankenstein? I would be very curious to know. Comment either below or on our social media feeds on that. Those of you not in the know, I am the drummer in two Arizona-based bands, The End of History and Nick Noodle and the Angel Hairs. The latter just headlined the other night at King Pigeon Thrift Store in downtown Phoenix. Great time. Sarah June, who is a local singer-songwriter, opened for us. EP, the guy who owns the shop, fantastic guy, really loves supporting local acts. Thank you so much for having us there. Anyone who was there at the show, thank you so much. You were an amazing crowd. We've been lucky enough to play two really great shows between the King Pigeon show and then at Santan Brewery about a week and a half, 2 weeks ago, something like that. I must tell you, it did not start out amazing because yours truly continues to be a grade A numbskull. I was setting up the drum kit and I realized something felt loose and out of place. And I realized I had forgotten my drum stool from the last show because for context, after that last show at the brewery, I had forgotten my drum stool because I was heading right to work and then flying out to California the next day. I forget my stool. I give it to Nick, who is our front man. He holds on to it, but I never got it back. So I'm setting up the kit the other night and I realize, okay, I have nowhere to sit. So EP, bless the man, finds this, you know, solid metal office chair out of like the 90s or early 2000s that is serviceable, but is not comfortable in any regard. So I'm literally feeling the backaches as we speak. I realize I forget my cymbals too, because again, from that brewery show, I thought, well, I'm going home to California the next day and I'm not going to leave my cymbals in a car that's going to wind up being 100 something degrees. So I left my cymbals in my air-conditioned apartment and just never took them out. So I have no drum stool, I have no cymbals. And then there was the mic stand, which I luckily had a mic stand to do backing vocals, but it didn't tighten at all. It barely worked. It was completely on its last legs. For about the first couple of minutes, I'm just trying to readjust this thing desperately. My bass player, James, and one of our kind of entourage friends of ours, Zane, aka UDMT, shout out to UDMT, go follow UDMT, he's fantastic. They were trying to help me keep the mic stand up for a couple songs, and then it just essentially collapsed on itself around song two, song three. So if you do wind up seeing the footage, and we are on YouTube at Nick Noodle and the Angel Hairs, if you do wind up seeing the footage, there is a point where the mic stand just comes out of view because it just became completely impractical. So here I am with no drum stool, no cymbals, a broken mic stand, and yet I did wind up playing pretty all right, and the acoustics sounded great. We didn't have Lauren, our keyboard player, for that. She will be at the next show, so we'll have the entire band for the next show, which we're really excited about, and I will move on to movie stuff in just a second, but really excited for the next show. It's going to be at the Rebel Lounge in downtown Phoenix. We're going to be opening for Cassidy Brook and Vintage Clothes on September 9th. That is a Tuesday coming up in September. Tickets will be available. They are in the description as we speak. If you can come see us, I'm really, really excited about the show. I have not played at Rebel in a long time, and I think all of us are losing our minds about it. So that's enough music talk for the moment. Nick Noodle and the Angel Hairs at Rebel Lounge in a couple of weeks. The End of History has stuff on the horizon, too. I'll talk about that when that comes closer. For now, why don't we talk about some movie things? We're going to keep it to three news topics today. I like the three and three idea. Reviews are a bit more flexible, but I think three news topics is more than enough, unless we have guests or whatever, or because it's a busy news week. For this week, we are starting off about the conversation around streaming movies and their respective studios giving or not giving them releases in theaters. One of the biggest question marks in that debate was going to be around Guillermo del Toro's new take on Frankenstein coming to Netflix, potentially or not potentially getting a theatrical release.
Hey, wasn't that part of the discussion questionnaire?
Yes, it was. You're very good at listening. The Hollywood Reporter confirmed from Netflix that it will be coming to theaters in some sort of limited release October 17th before hitting Netflix a month later on November 7th. Now, for those of you who have been deep in this conversation, you might remember Glass Onion, the sequel to Knives Out. We're getting the sequel to that movie, Wake Up Dead Man, later this year. But when Glass Onion was coming out in 2022, there was a whole hoopla about Rian Johnson wanting it to get a theatrical release. Netflix yielded. They gave it a one-week release in September before it released in November. And people were grateful, but they were not exactly ecstatic about it. And I know because I was one of those people who was grateful to see it in theaters, but was not ecstatic that I only had like 3 or 4 days to do it. If you have not been in the loop about this, Oscar Isaac is Victor Frankenstein in this version. Jacob Elordi from Euphoria and Saltburn is playing the monster. You've got people like Christoph Waltz, Charles Dance, Mia Goth in this version. It has been a huge passion play for Del Toro since at least 2007, 2008. There was an original setup over at Universal, and then Del Toro got very, very busy and the budget got very, very big. His version for Netflix is set to come off his big Academy Award run for the stop-motion Pinocchio movie that he did with Mark Osborne back in 2022. Now, as far as just the news around this, I'm so excited. I have been looking forward to this since I first heard, since I first discovered Del Toro way back in, 2013, 2014 with the Pacific Rim days. And I think in those interviews, at some point, I heard him talking about Frankenstein and going, wow, that'd be so cool. This is the younger 2013 version of me. Wow, that'd be so cool to see him do a Frankenstein movie. And now he's finally getting to do a Frankenstein movie. If you have not seen the trailer that came out earlier this summer, it looks so good. The sets look so good. Oscar Isaac looks so good. We don't see much of Jacob Elordi, but he sounds completely alien. Jacob Elordi has been a performer who I've had question marks about for many years. I saw the first Kissing Booth movie. I thought he was fine in it. I've never seen an episode of Euphoria. I thought he was good in Saltburn, but he gets overshadowed by several other performers, which is ironic because that's apparently the performance that Del Toro saw and convinced him to put him in Frankenstein. Oscar Isaac, I have no qualms with. I think he's going to be a fantastic Victor Frankenstein. Elordi is just the big question mark I have, but the movie looks so good. And I was chiming in along with a lot of other people online about the concerns that we wouldn't be able to see this get a Glass Onion run. But regardless of how good it is, I think this is a movie that, as Del Toro has said before, deserves to be seen on the big screen. I can't wait to see it. But the big thing I'm curious about is whether or not, again, the period between October 17th and November 7th, if that will literally be a full, 600-700 theater run, or if it'll literally be a week or two, go out of theaters, and then come onto Netflix. I hope it's not that. I hope Netflix really does go the full mile with it, because I think it deserves it. But we will have to wait and see. We next turn to the world of one Zack Snyder, and I proceed with this cautiously. For those of you in the know, the director has spent the last few years over at the aforementioned Netflix. He's been doing his two Rebel Moon films. He was hoping to do more. It doesn't look like we're going to get more of those. Basically, Rebel Moon was his version of Star Wars. It exists. I'd be very curious to talk about it at some point. This was during the hiatus for our podcast here, but I'd be very curious to talk about it at some point because it's a movie that they are two movies that are chocked full of ideas. Anyways, he has a couple projects in the works right now. He has an Army of the Dead sequel he's working on. There's a film around the UFC that he wants to do. Neither of those will be his next movie, nor will there be any DC films for any of you asking. This is per Deadline. This month, Snyder is set to start filming The Last Photograph. The film essentially follows, this is the quoted synopsis again from Deadline, quote, an ex-DEA operative who must return to the mountains of South America in an effort to find his missing niece and nephew following the brutal murders of their diplomat parents, enlisting the help of a washed-up junkie war photographer, the only person to have seen the face of the killers, he sets out determined to find the children and the truth, but soon learns he must also face the ghosts of his past. The film is set to reunite Snyder with two of his Rebel Moon cast members, Stuart Martin and Fra Free, both of whom worked again with him on Rebel Moon. Martin, you might also know from the UK Sky series Jamestown, and Free, you might remember as one of the tracksuit mafia members from the Hawkeye series on Disney+. We have no release date for The Last Photograph, and even though Zack Snyder's The Stone Quarry is producing this, we don't know who's distributing it either in theaters or on streaming. Zack Snyder is not my favorite filmmaker in the world, but he is someone who I deeply admire, especially post the Snyder Cut for what it is, which is a gargantuan, beautiful, convoluted mess of a movie, which I wish was a miniseries, but it is what it is. The Rebel Moon films, as you probably established, are not my favorite things in the world, nor are many of his films. But I am curious to see what he can do with this. He did issue a brief statement in that Deadline article about the idea of using the camera in a kind of chase environment, which I hope just doesn't mean he's going to rely on shaky cam. I don't know if Zack Snyder and shaky cam is something that I necessarily want to embrace. The tagline is interesting, though. I think the idea of two people, you know, an ex-DEA operative and a, you know, ex-war photographer, the idea of people who were in the midst of these conflicts having to go back into this war space, I think that could be interesting. Do I trust Zack Snyder to completely flesh out the characters of that? Not necessarily. But again, if in the, you know, post-Justice League, post-Rebel Moon stuff, if he wants to go something smaller with this, I think this is exactly the thing he should be doing. We forget that before he became Mr. DC, Mr. 300, Mr. All That, you know, this was the guy who remade Dawn of the Dead on a pretty shoestring budget with, aside from Ving Rhames, not too many well-known people. And so I like the idea of him going back to basics, theoretically outside of a studio system, and just doing a story that he likes and going back to his roots and making clear about that, you know, that he's not just Mr. Big Flashy Effects, that he can tell a comprehensive story. I don't know how well it'll work out. It's not something I'm necessarily chomping at the bit for, but the fact that he's going in this direction instead of, you know, Rebel Moon Part 5, that I'm really encouraged by. And I would like to think, and I'm not necessarily going to dive into the Snyder Bro fan base, but I would hope that for as fanatical as those fans are, and for as exuberant and loving of Zack Snyder's work as they have been, I'm curious if they will go to this in the same regard. I wonder, you know, is it the thing of they just love the Snyderverse characters and all of that, or are they going to support his work all the way? That's something I'm very curious about, and how that may or may not affect him, because he's always had a good relationship with that fan base, but I'm curious how well that'll translate to something that is a seemingly original small budget idea. So that's where I stand on that. And finally for today, a trip to Riverdale. No, not the CW series. I have seen two episodes of that, and I am not walking back into that discussion right now. Although at some point, I'm gonna have to watch it because I have too much affinity for CW programming not to. There's a few of you probably listening to this who are very excited about that. Don't. It's not gonna be for a while because there's like six seasons of it and I've heard where the plot goes and I don't want to deal with that. But Archie Comics. This was first reported by the Insider earlier this week and then corroborated by the Hollywood Reporter. There is apparently an Archie movie set in development over at Universal Studios, and none other than Phil Lord and Chris Miller are producing it. If those names don't sound immediately familiar, think 21 Jump Street, the Lego movie, the recent Spider-Verse movies, the upcoming Project Hail Mary with Ryan Gosling, they're behind that. No word if they'll direct this. But involved in the writing side, you have Tom King, who is the Eisner-winning comic book writer behind series like Vision and Supergirl Woman of Tomorrow. He's also attached over at the aforementioned DC Studios. He's going to be doing the Lantern series over with James Gunn. I believe he's attached to a couple other things over there as well. Back in the 90s, there was an attempt to get an Archie film off the ground, also at Universal. For unknown reasons, that never panned out. There was also an attempt back in 2013 with Jason Moore, who directed the first Pitch Perfect movie. That also never went through. Though notably, that take was over at Warner Brothers. I'm not sure how the rights swapped around necessarily, but it is interesting to note that that was around the same time that the Riverdale TV series was getting off the ground. So potentially that might have just been a thing of we couldn't get the movie to work out, so we're going to rework it as a TV series. Don't take that as concrete fact, but it just sounds like that may have been how it rolled between 2013 and 2014. other than that, we have only had two real film attempts at Archie comics in theaters. We had the L. Font Kaplan 2001 Josie and the Pussycats movie, and an Indian adaptation called The Archies that went straight to Netflix back in 2023. I am all for whatever Lord and Miller want to do. I'm big fans of theirs. They're super, super creative guys. I will always love them for, again, taking the Lego movie and making it as spectacular as it is. Even a decade removed, I think that film is... Even a decade removed, I think that movie is really, really special. The 21 Jump Street films are so much fun. They didn't direct the Spider-Verse movies, but they had a heavy hand in how those movies are constructed and what they wanted to do with that. I'm really excited for Hail Mary. Archie, this isn't to disparage Archie by any means. Archie has been around for nearly 9 decades. Like, I am not about to be out here disparaging a comic book company that is literally a year older than the first Jeep. But that being said, I don't know, I've maybe read like a half a dozen Archie comics in my life. I've watched like, again, 2 episodes of Riverdale. I've never seen the Josie and the Pussycats movie outside of, you know, a couple of clips. I didn't know the Indian adaptation of the Archies existed until I was literally doing research for this story. It's apparently gotten mixed reviews. I'd be curious to watch it. Archie comics is not necessarily something that I have deep personal attachment to, but the idea that Lord Miller are behind this is really encouraging. The fact that they've been trying to get this off the ground for so long, and that there hasn't been an Archie big screen movie in nearly 90 years feels weird. Like, it would be like if there had never been a Looney Tunes movie by this point. It just seems completely out there, which I guess technically there have been, but like a North American theatrically released Archie's movie, when that is so ingrained into, you know, 50s style Americana imagery, it's weird that it hasn't been. The bigger question mark I have is Tom King. For those of you who may not be in the know, has, again, written some acclaimed comic runs, several of which I have read. I mentioned the Vision series, which is amazing. I read the Supergirl series, which is fantastic. I even briefly picked up his Batman Elmer Fudd crossover, which, by the way, the DC Looney Tunes stuff is really fun. If you can track it down, it's really fun. However, in specifically comic fan spaces, there's some vitriol towards Tom King, partially for his Wonder Woman run, partially for some things that he has said about his time previously in the CIA that people have not taken kindly to, and that I can't even blame them about. But regardless, he is someone who, in the last year or so, I've started to become a little bit skeptical on. And again, especially as he's seemingly moving out of comics into becoming, you know, more TV and film based, he's one of essentially what have been dubbed the architects of the new DC universe over at Warner Brothers, that he's, you know, adapting the Supergirl movie. He's writing on the Lantern series. I trust Lord Miller. I think they know what they're doing in trying to take a property like Archie Comics and move it into 2025 and make it something that is legitimately compelling and emotional and interesting. I don't know if Tom King is the right person for that, but I'm going to be keeping my eye on this one. All right, when we come back, review time, Americana, Honey Don't, Highest to Lowest. We're going to talk about all of it. Stretch your legs, grab a drink, do what you got to do. We'll be back here in just a minute or so with the movie review portion of the show. I'm Brandon King from Plot Devices. Stay tuned. All right, everyone, we're back into episode 53 of Plot Devices. Hope you got your stretching. Hope you got your drinks. We're all good. Everyone's back here. Take a deep breath. We're all here. Movie news over with. Go back and check those out if you haven't. We're on to the movie review section. It's all opinions from here on out, and hopefully good ones. We're starting off with a little movie called Americana. This premiered over at South by Southwest. It's a kind of modern take on like an ensemble Western crime thriller-esque thing. Again, premiered at South by Southwest back in 2023, only just getting distribution in the U.S. This past couple of weeks or so by Lionsgate. Significant ensemble cast on this one. You have Sydney Sweeney, Paul Walter Hauser, Halsey, the singer Halsey, Simon Rex, Zahn McLaren, really solid cast here. Essentially, there's a couple of intertwining story. It's one of those movies with like 4 or 5 storylines that all kind of converge that I will try to be as concise with as possible. to start off, you have Sidney Sweeney and Paul Walter Hauser. This all mostly takes place in a small town in South Dakota, by the way. You have Sidney Sweeney, who is working as this pretty shy waitress at this diner. She wants to be a singer, a la Loretta Lynn, Dolly Parton, that kind of archetype. But she doesn't really perform for anyone. She just kind of goes about her days and works and goes home. Paul Walter Hauser is a rancher, I believe, who has really profoundly terrible luck with women. We literally start his character off with he's dating a character, another like side character for about two or three dates, and then proposes to her. That's what we're dealing with. They meet and they kind of hit it off. They're not necessarily a couple yet, but they find, you know, comfort in one another. Enter Halsey's character and what we are led to believe is her little brother, played by Gavin Bergman. Cal was the brother's name. Cal is a, I think, 9 or 10 year old white boy who believes himself to be the reincarnation of Sitting Bull. So he's enamored. We see him early on. He's enamored by like Westerns he sees on television. He has a bow and arrow. He, you know, gets like a Native American headscarf, all because he believes he is meant to be reunited with who he believes is his people. Many characters point out that this is not right, including Zahn McClarnon, who is dealing in restoring Lakota and Native American community and heritage to the area, meets this kid and is like, this is insensitive. But however, in the midst of all of this, you have Halsey's character, who has essentially come into possession of, what is this, ghost shirt. And we learn that essentially they were shirts worn by the Lakota back in the 1700s, 1800s, and they were meant to use spiritual abilities to keep one shielded from harm. This was acquired by this rich guy out of South Dakota, played by Simon Rex from Red Rocket, if you remember him. He gets the shirt, and through various means, Halsey's character acquires it, Sidney Sweeney and Paul Walter Hauser's character after, because it basically costs, you know, $1 million. It's incredibly rare and incredibly valuable to a lot of parties, to this this black market dealer, to this Native American group, to this boy who wants to return it, to Sidney Sweeney's character who wants to sell it and make money to move out to Nashville, to Halsey's character who wants to help her and the boy get out of an abusive household. And so you have all of these parties coalescing over this shirt in the midst of this small South Dakota town that eventually moves out of the South Dakota town, but I won't say too much more than that. That might sound really convoluted. But yes, basically what you have to know is that it's a bunch of people going after this Native American artifact for their own gains, which vary from cultural heritage to just pure greed. It's all very messy and striated and separate, but it kind of comes together fairly well. This is from Tony Tost, who is a first-time feature director. You might know his name from series like Damnation and The Terror and the most recent season of Poker Face, which I need to get to. I was literally just talking the other day about how for whatever reason, I haven't watched Poker Face, and it looks right up my alley, but I have not watched it yet. So I have not been exposed to this guy. You can tell that he is coming from a perspective of, you know, Quentin Tarantino and the Coen brothers and, you know, David Mackenzie. And that idea of, you know, the kind of refurbished Western that takes those tropes and that imagery and puts it into a modern context with modern issue and social cues behind it. I can't tell you the entire film works. What I will say, though, is that some of the performances here are pretty good. I love Zahn McClarnon. I think Dark Winds is fantastic. Every time I see this guy, I think he's fantastic, and I truly think he should be getting more work. I will say the most I was interested in was between the kid and Halsey's character. Halsey, by the way, who we're going to talk about A$AP Rocky later on in Highest to Lowest, and who I kind of foreshadowed last week about the idea of musicians and rappers journeying into film. I didn't see Maxine. Halsey's good in this. Like, is Halsey a good actress now? Because after this, I'm convinced she might be. She is able to take, Mandy is her character's name. Mandy is, again, a messy character. You find out a lot about her backstory as the movie goes on. The movie almost winds up revolving around her. And in some ways, it does become very tragic, but it also becomes very much a thing where she causes a lot of this and she has to rectify her own mistakes. And she becomes, again, maybe the most sympathetic layered character in the movie. She's able to play it with a lot of confidence. She's able to play it with just enough kind of smirk to the camera, just enough kind of swagger and cool to her to play off of performers like Sydney Sweeney and Paul Walter Hauser and Zal McLarnon. And it really works out. You know, Eric Dane's good in this. Gavin Bergman, who is the kid, I'm sure there's some of you thinking, like, how do you make that character not incredibly insensitive? And you know what? There's some kind of charm there, especially when you get the scenes between him and Zal McLarnon and the idea of what Native Americans have lost in the modern era, the idea of the Western tropes carrying over. And now here's this kid who's trying to reinforce, you know, the 1800s idea of who Sitting Bull was and his dreams and the idea of what native communities today face. Those kinds of interactions are really palpable. And I will say this, the actual final scene of the movie, the actual final action scene of the movie, which I won't spoil, but it involves a shootout. And when you look at like the visual symmetry of it and where every character is and what they're all fighting over and what they're asking about, if you look at that through the lens of like Western history, there is something really palpable there. Like Tony Toss is locking into an idea of Western iconography and Western legacy, like the legacy of what those Western images are. He's locking into an idea about that that is kind of profound by the end, and that is kind of exciting. Like, you do, again, maybe the first half doesn't necessarily do it any favors, but eventually you do get really invested in the chase of this shirt and why people are going after it and, you know, convincing themselves that it's the way they're going to get out of their problems. Again, it's not for lack of trying. I will say the movie, again, is not perfect by any stretch. That first 30 to 40 minutes doesn't really work. Sydney Sweeney and Paul Walter Hauser, like, bless them for trying. Their characters are not amazing. They're giving their best effort. There's a sweet scene between two of them and the idea of Sydney Sweeney's musical education, where she wants to go. That's kind of sweet, but the rest of the movie, they're just kind of there. They try to make some callbacks later on to really establish their relationship, and like, I don't buy it for a second. The music is not particularly memorable. The shot compositions are fine. Like, the cinematography is good, but like, we'll talk about Honey Don't in a minute, but that movie, I think, does a lot more of like the small town atmosphere and production design that this movie does. So bottom line, I don't hate this by any means. I know it's been getting really mixed reviews. It's a movie that I think could have been way, way worse, and that I found a lot more to consider about it and eat up as a filmgoer about it. Again, if nothing else shows me that Halsey should act, and I should maybe want her in more things. It's solid for what it is. It's not exceptional necessarily. I would really be curious to see what Tony Toss could do next in developing these ideas and that kind of, you know, big sporadic ensemble of characters who come together by this one thing, and there's an energy to them, and it's, you know, zany but powerful and poignant. I think there's something in there, but I don't think this is that. So again, Americana should be still playing in a number of theaters near you. It will be on VOD soon. Yeah, check it out. It's not half bad. This is Honey Don't. This is from Ethan Coen of the Coen Brothers. If you didn't know, the Coen Brothers essentially went their separate ways. I don't think there's necessarily bad blood between them, but they've essentially gone their separate ways as filmmakers. Joel Coen went off and made The Tragedy of Macbeth a couple of years ago, which is, if you haven't seen it, it's on Apple TV, and it is a lot, but it's excellent. And Joel, meanwhile, has gone off to make what he calls his lesbian B-movie trilogy, which he co-wrote with Trisha Cook, who is his partner and also editor on these films. The first of those was Drive Away Dolls last year with Margaret Qualley and Geraldine Viswanathan. Now we get Honey Don't, and we're supposed to get a third one either next year or the following year at some point. But as far as Honey Don't, Margaret Qualley is in here, sole lead in the movie, as Honey O'Donoghue, an outwardly lesbian, and that is very important, private eye in Bakersfield, California. She doesn't really like people all that much. She has an assistant who she doesn't really task with a lot of things. She just likes doing things herself. She has her sister in town, played by Kristen Connolly, and a niece who she's very protective of, played by Talia Ryder from Due Revenge. And she just kind of, you know, she solves the cases in town that, like, the police can't, and it's that kind of detective noir trope. One day, there is a car crash, a woman dies, and she's at first wearing this ring of this local church. The ring is then stolen. We then find out why. And when Honey discovers the crash, she discovers something kind of peculiar about it, and she starts finding these connections between this murder victim and a church led by Chris Evans, aka Captain America, as Reverend Devlin, who is this essentially cult leader. Preaches a lot of very non-specific platitude things. He does a lot of really dirty, sketchy things. He's working with some really sketchy people on the back, including a drug dealer who winds up essentially getting hit over with a car, which Honey then investigates and leads to more questions about this church. And that is essentially the plot around this. There is a slight subplot with Margaret Qualley's character and Aubrey Plaza, who pops up as a police officer, also openly lesbian. They have a relationship, and it's sexy and out there and wild in its own right. And that's kind of the movie. This is, like Driveaway Dolls, super light, super inconsequential kind of fare. This isn't, you know, what the Coen brothers were doing in the 2000s with, you know, No Country for Old Men or any of the stuff they were doing. This is Ethan Coen very much going out of the way just to, you know, have fun with his wife, get some cool actors in there, get like the normal tech people in there that he's been working with for years. So Carter Burwell on the score, Ari Wegner does the cinematography for this, and like just Stephane Deschamps does the production design here, and just getting a lot of like his friends and cool collaborators together and just making these scrappy, low-budget movies. And on that level, I highly respect that, and I love the fact that he just gets to do that. And I know that there are not a lot, but there are a handful of people out there who will not shut up about their love of Driveaway Dolls. I know one of them is listening to this, and I very much respect you for it. I did not love Driveaway Dolls. I loved the kind of odd couple dynamic between Margaret Qualley and Geraldine Viswanathan. Here, you again just get Margaret Qualley, and to be fair, she is the best part of the movie. There is a kind of unmitigated swagger to Honey O'Donoghue as a character. She's someone who very much knows what she wants to get out of a day-to-day basis, but not necessarily out of a lifeline basis. She doesn't necessarily know what she wants to do in terms of a family or staying in town or necessarily, but she knows that while she's here, she has a gift for solving these crimes, and she has this presence about her that she can turn the tables on any situation. Like, there's a whole subplot with her and Charlie Day from It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia, who pops up as this other cop who is constantly trying to ask her out, and she is just coming up with constant new reasons of why, like, oh, you know, give me your cell phone number. I can't. I just have like a whole purse full of quarters they use for a payphone. And it's funny. It's charming. Like, there's electricity to whenever she is just allowed to be the character on screen. And with the supporting cast, you know, it's fun to see Aubrey Plaza get to be in a role that I will simply say goes into places later on that I think could be really fun for her as a performer. Chris Evans gets to be a total sleazebag. And I think I'm not alone in saying, like, after Captain America, it's really cool to be reminded that, yeah, Chris Evans is a really versatile actor, and to see him get to do this without an ounce of, you know, wink to the camera and just be this, again, terrible manipulative cult leader is kind of fun. I like some of the production design. It makes Bakersfield feel very lived in and small town and isolated in its own right, but also feel very, you know, versatile and alive in its own really quirky kind of way. The opening credits are also really cool. Like, I'm not going to recommend the movie purely on the opening credits, but, like, the opening credits are really cool in establishing, you know, the buildings and the streets and the way that this town is laid out. It is kind of very fun. But that's about where my positives end. Like, the movie is so meandering. It's the same problem that Driveaway Dolls had, but arguably worse, because you don't have, again, that central odd couple bouncy dynamic between Margaret Qualley and Geraldine Viswanathan. Now you just have the central character. But the movie, for as much as it wants to embrace Honey's messiness, it doesn't let her drive the story necessarily. The story becomes more driven by, like, her niece and, again, the cult leader and stuff like that. And this other side character played by Lara Abova, who's, like, this French drug agent who works with Chris Evans' character. Again, it goes off in a lot of different directions. The stuff with, you know, Honey's family is there but not really given a lot. There's a whole subplot later about, like, other family members coming into the picture that goes nowhere. There's stuff with, you know, Aubrey Plaza's character that I guess is interesting, but is not given a lot of depth to really sink in. It just kind of happens. And in that same way, the movie will just kind of end not to spoil it, but like, I've talked to several people and they have had the same reaction of, that's the ending of your movie. Okay. And not even a thing of, oh, wow, the, you know, the ending shot gave me so much to think about. No, it's just a scene that happens that could go somewhere, that could help develop some threads of the story, but the movie ends and it does not give you a lot. Now, again, like Drive Away Dolls, I have heard some people say, you're overthinking this. That's not the point. Again, it's supposed to be, you know, light, zany, character-driven, you know, borderline parody kind of fare that is honoring, you know, the tropes of the detective story and the neo-noir story that we've seen a million times. And it doesn't give you a lot to soak on that beyond we're doing these things, wink, wink, nudge, nudge. Even if, again, Margaret Qualley is so electric in her own subtle way in the role, similar to like kind of an opposite way of The Substance, if you saw that, where she is allowed to go bigger and bigger and bigger in that movie, and here she has to be almost more contained as the movie goes on. As a fan of hers and seeing her dynamics as a performer, that is really cool, but that's not enough to recommend the movie. And look, if this is how Ethan Coen wants to spend his time, great. I'm probably going to check out whatever that third movie is going to be. I know there are going to be people who this is going to be right up your alley. If you see the trailer and it looks really just, again, electric and silly and just not taking itself too seriously, the movie is just shy of 90 minutes. You can get in and out fairly quickly if you're looking for something just rather quick. It is in theaters right now. It's from Universal. I assume it'll be on Peacock streaming in probably the next 2 months. If it sounds up your alley and you are a diehard Coen Brothers fan, maybe give it a shot, but it's not something that I would be jumping up and down to encourage you to see. Spike Lee is back in theaters, quote unquote. This actually ties in perfectly to the original topic of the show for today, and I totally planned that. Completely. I'm that smart. Highest to Lowest is on Apple TV in about a week or so. But for now, as far as recording this and hopefully when you're listening to this, you can catch it in a theater. At least here in Arizona, there's about 3 or 4 theaters. AMC isn't. What the heck, guys? Again, going to the idea of streamers saying, we would like people to go to our streaming services, which makes fair business sense. But at the same time, if you have a Spike Lee Denzel Washington movie, put it in the theater because my theater was packed. I know other theaters across the country are getting sold out. This is what I'm talking about from this topic. Regardless, Spike Lee is back in theaters and eventually on Apple TV Plus with Denzel Washington. This is a remake of an Akira Kurosawa movie called High and Low, which I admit has been on my list for a long time and I just didn't get around to before this. It's still on my list. I'm hopefully going to be able to get to it this week. It's self-based on the Evan Hunter novel King Ransom. We follow Denzel Washington as David King, which is funny because this is actually, I think, the third King we've referenced in this show for today. There's myself, we mentioned Tom King earlier, now David King. This is the episode of Kings. I'm going to name the episode that. Hold me to it. David King is a modern-day music mogul. Think along the lines of, you know, those like late 90s, early 2000s, specifically hip-hop and R&B moguls who, you know, made a ton of money in the CD era. Defined as like the best ears in the business is what they call him in the movie. He lives in this giant luxurious penthouse with his wife, played here by Ilfenesh Hadera, and his son, played by Aubrey Joseph, who I didn't recognize at first, and then I was like, oh, shoot, he's the kid from Cloak and Dagger. Good for him. So he's living with his family here. He's essentially in the process of buying back the ownership of the label that made him famous, and he's going through all these like financial transactions. One day, his son is essentially at basketball training, along with another boy who is the son of Denzel Washington's chauffeur, Paul, who is played by Jeffrey Wright. So you have both Denzel Washington and Jeffrey Wright in this, which in itself is insane. But you have both Denzel and Jeffrey's kids who are in this basketball training camp. They're essentially gone. Nobody has any idea where they are. They call the FBI. And it turns out that several kidnappers led by A$AP Rocky have kidnapped the two boys, but then they release one of them thinking he's just not important. Turns out that's Denzel Washington's son. So instead, now they have kidnapped Jeffrey Wright's son instead. And the kidnappers are asking for this $17.5 million payout, which Denzel was originally going to use to buy back the share of his label. Now here comes the big conundrum. Does he use the money to go forward with the sale and, again, leave the kid to his devices and potentially the law enforcement to save him? Or does he just pay the ransom and do what is essentially the right thing with whatever the consequences may be? This is where we are left with the movie. You also have people in this, like Wendell Pierce as one of Denzel Washington's record label advisory people. You have Michael Potts in there as well. Ice Spice pops up in a blink and you'll miss it role. Among the law enforcement members is Dean Winters, aka the guy is Mayhem from the Allstate commercial. So it's a really eclectic kind of cast. And then you have like cameos from like Don Lemon and Rosie Perez. The late Eddie Palmieri is in this. And it's a movie that I've heard a lot of people have a lot of slightly mixed thoughts on. It does have a pretty good Rotten Tomatoes score at the moment, but I've heard some mixed responses on it, partly from people who have seen the original High and Low. Again, I am not coming from that direction, and even possibly more out of focus, my relationship with Spike Lee is weird. The Spike Lee movies I have seen and have engaged with are either in the last few years, so that's Black Klansman, Defy Bloods, This, American Utopia, or it's some of his really earlier work, whether it's Malcolm X, Do the Right Thing, She's Gotta Have It, which actually, the latter of which, She's Gotta Have It, we reviewed on this very show a while ago. I'll link that episode if you want to check that out. But the long and short of it then is that between Malcolm X and Black Klansman, so that period of like 26 years, almost something like that, I don't have a lot of experience with Spike Lee. So again, Crooklyn, Get on the Bus, Inside Man, Miracle at St. Anna, like I've never seen any of those. And I came up during a time when it was very much Spike Lee as this kind of shaky career point when he was a visionary. I mean, he had done so much, but the idea was like, where was he going to be going next? And then it turns out that like he's had a pretty prolific 2020 so far. Like, I think American Utopia is amazing. Defy Bloods, Delroy Lindo should have been nominated for an Oscar that year. And I'm never going to stop yelling about how he wasn't. Why wasn't Delroy Lindo nominated for an Oscar that year? And now he's got this, which has been in development for a long time. I know like the screenwriter Alan Fox has pitched this for at least 5 or 6 years, if not longer. And then apparently Spike Lee got a hold of it and sent it over to Denzel, and that's why we're getting this. And while I will not say Highest to Lowest has the same pure visceral electricity of something like Defy Bloods or American Utopia, or even something like Black Klansman in its best moments, I really did wind up liking it. The highs in Highest to Lowest, pun intended, are so good. There's a couple, and I mean a couple, there's like two really big action set pieces, one involving the New York subway, another involving Denzel and A$AP Rocky's characters, that are so grippingly shot. I should mention Matthew Libatique is the cinematographer on this, who also did stuff like the recent A Star is Born remake and Black Swan and Straight Outta Compton. He recently did Maestro with Bradley Cooper. He's an incredibly visually savvy, you know, very color-forward cinematographer who can get a lot of really cool angles and directions out of this. And some of the camera moments, like you'll see conversations with characters shot from different angles. There's one that I remember with like Denzel Washington and his wife, and they're on the balcony scene of their penthouse, and we're seeing it from like the living room as it like slowly pans in. Or like there'll be that that chasing that's on the subway, and the close-ups of Denzel and the agents as they're on the train, and cutting between that with the help of Barry Brown and Allison Johnson's editing, in cutting between that and this performance by Eddie Palmieri at this Puerto Rican rally, it's absolutely electric. The movie is not all that, though. It's a lot of people sitting around in rooms and discussing, like, the worth of David, Denzel Washington, of David's character and his legacy and where someone like him goes in the 2020s. This is a movie that very much is concerned with, like, streaming and, you know, TikTok stardom. There's a whole thing where, like, one of the complications about the whole kidnapping situation is solved, and we see how David is perceived in the media about it. And it's good, but it also leads to consequences that he himself is too stubborn to think through, and that people around him are trying to tell him, like, yeah, like, you did a good thing, but, like, at what cost? And it's this really interesting morality take on a decision like this that itself is really gripping in itself, but it leads to a lot of interesting things. But the movie a lot of times does wind up stopping a few too many times to try and sit with those things while there are other things going on that should be going, that we should be focusing on. Again, the movie is 2 hours and 10 minutes, and it does feel that way. It's not necessarily a movie that flies by at the speed of sound necessarily. It doesn't drag necessarily either, but there are points that, again, those two or three high moments of, you know, the chase sequences, the dialogue between Denzel and A$AP Rocky's character, and just some of the stuff between like him and his kid. There's a scene with Denzel and his kid that is really palpable, and the idea of what would you do if you had those resources, and you have someone like Jeffrey Wright's character who is literally like a brother to you, and this other kid who's basically your surrogate nephew or your surrogate other son who means the world to you, and would you throw away everything to help that person, even with risk to yourself? And it raises a lot of really interesting questions, again, about the merits of capitalism and what you can do with those benefits, what you should do with those benefits, and how will that help you, yourself, the people around you. It's not necessarily critiquing those ideas per se, but it is reflecting those ideas. And I think it does so in a really dynamic way that is enhanced by the crime caper elements, the thriller elements. And the through line of all of that, you also have A$AP Rocky, who, this is not his first acting role. He was in like Dope and a couple other things. And there's at least two scenes where he has to go head to head with Denzel. And like Halsey that I mentioned in Americana, this is another role of a musician taking on a role and really stepping up to the plate. Like, he has such charisma and swagger and energy to his role. Granted, for lack of a better term, he is playing a version of himself. This is a character who is a rapper and does talk and speak in a way like A$AP Rocky does. Like, this is not necessarily a transformative role per se. He's embodying the weight and, as we find out, his own emotional stakes of the character that back and forth against Denzel's character are so just gripping to watch. Like, one of the scenes that I'm mentioning, I would almost watch like a 20-minute sequence of just that. It's that interesting. So at the end of the day, it's well shot, it's well acted, it's well directed. So I haven't mentioned Spike Lee, but he does a really great job balancing a lot of this, maybe not uniformly, but certainly in the broad strokes. It is also a movie about music, but mostly about the music business. And again, without maybe getting too spoilery, by the end of it, we're supposed to buy into this idea of David coming around to his own belief around his love of music and his appreciation of art above commerce. And that's also one of the messier writing portions of the movie. Again, this movie was sort of retrofitted from the original High to Low to take place around like the New York hip hop scene and things like that. And it's one of those things where I believe that Spike Lee and Alan Fox and Denzel Washington believe of what this is going for. Like, whatever that, what that final scene is on paper should hit you like a truck. And to me, I didn't feel like by that point that was the emotion we were going for. Not that it's not worth being in the movie, it very much is. And it certainly works on, like, if you wrote it down as like, here's where the character goes from A to B to C. That all works out. But it's not necessarily a movie that loves music so much that you can feel it soaking out of it. It's almost a movie that keeps music and art and artists at almost an arm's length because of those barriers of the music industry and record labels and, you know, out of control capitalism. It tries its best to go to that angle of like, yes, but it is all about the art and the wonder of it and the expression of it. But it does wind up being one of the things that I wish the movie did a little bit better. But bottom line, this is still a really good Spike Lee movie. The highs are, again, pun intended, so good. And the lows are not nearly distracting enough to make me not recommend the movie. Denzel is great here. A$AP Rocky is terrific. I haven't mentioned Jeffrey Wright a lot, but he gets some really great moments as well. It's shot so well. It's edited within an inch of its life. It's a really great kind of drama crime thriller. Again, it's in theaters now. It'll be on Apple TV in a couple weeks. But if you can get to it in theaters, I think you'll have a really good time with this. It's funny at times. It can be very emotional at points. And again, there's so many good parts about it that even if I don't think it's on the level of, say, a Malcolm X or a Defy of Bloods, it's still worth your time. Check this out. And finally for today, in terms of reviews, it's a big one. We're talking K-pop Demon Hunters on Netflix and in theaters. If you were one of the lucky few to contribute to the $20 million box office end of AUKUS smash that I'm sure we're going to get into, I literally pushed back the episode so we could get a review on here. And joining me is friend of the show, from the original era, from the abridged reboot era, and now from the reboot of the reboot era, Danielle Bokenkamp. Feature me. Do your cool, exhaustive editing thing. Danielle Bokenkamp is joining us. How are you today?
I'm great. I am absolutely ecstatic to be back on my favorite podcast. How are you?
You don't listen to a lot of podcasts then, and I respect that. K-pop Demon Hunters has taken over the planet. Danielle, do you want to try and give a quick synopsis of what we're dealing with here?
Yeah, so basically K-pop Demon Hunters is kind of exactly what it sounds like. It's a K-pop girl group, and they're also secretly like demon hunters on the side. They are trying to protect the Hanmoon, which is basically just like it kind of like separates their world from the demon world. And they are nearly successful when they are met with a demon boy band that kind of shakes everything up. So, I'd say that's a pretty good summary.
Pretty much. And then you have Rumi, Mira, and Zoe in there, played by Arden Cho, Mei Hong, and Ji-Young Yu. I apologize in advance. I'm going to screw up some pronunciation here. You also have Ije, Audrey Numa, and Rei Ami providing the singing voices. So Arden Cho is the acting performance for Rumi. Ije is the singing performance. This is directed here by Maggie Kang, Chris Appelhans. Neither name was familiar to me. Maggie Kang is a Canadian filmmaker. Chris is American. They were both on movies like Puss in Boots and Rise of the Guardians, I believe. I think Chris has made his directorial debut already. I'm blanking on what exactly it was, but I think this is Maggie Kang's directorial debut on her end. But yes, as you say, girl group, K-pop, demons, and then there's a boy band in there as well, the leader of which voiced by An Hyo Seop. Again, I apologize. I'm pissing off a ton of people right now. And yeah, the movie is kind of on that level, what you might expect, and also a lot more. I'm curious your thoughts going in. Number one, I don't think we've talked about this before, if you're in any K-pop fandoms, of what your expectations were going into that on that level. And number two, what the movie did on that general appeal level, if it did at all.
Don't listen to K-pop myself, and I do love animation, so I was pretty excited for this, but I didn't really know what to expect. I know a lot of people have told me like, oh, I don't want to watch that, I'm not into K-pop, but I genuinely think that this like transcends that genre. If you're somebody who doesn't know a lot about K-pop or doesn't like K-pop, you can still watch this movie and get so much from it.
I would agree. I have been that guy who's kind of had K-pop for many reasons as a genre at kind of arm's length, not necessarily because I don't like it by any. I've heard K-pop songs that I like. I like Blackpink, A Fair Deal. Obviously has BTS in there. It has, you know, other groups that I've heard from here and there. And on that level, I was intimidated going into it because I knew that if you are into this world and this kind of, you know, the world of like Korean idols and that level of social media appeal and that style of especially like modern trap infused K-pop, you're going to be eating this up on that level alone. And I was kind of scared that it was going to, again, like put me at arm's length more than I already was. And I will tell you what, I'm glad we weren't doing this podcast during Wicked, because this feels kind of a similar situation where I can stand up and say K-pop Demon Hunters is very good. Does that mean you think it's great? I think it's very good. And I know because everyone else is adoring this, including people I really, really respect in either the space or just in the fandom circles alone. And I love that a movie like this, number one, and we'll talk about the theatrical kimono in probably a second, but I love that it is sparking such a huge discussion as it is. But it is the very much thing of like, I can say, you know, a dozen plus things that I really, really love about this. And yet that extra oomph thing that people had with Wicked that I didn't have, I'm reminded of the, and again, both are musicals, so what does that say about me? I have that in kind of the same way with this.
That is very interesting. I really want to know what it was that didn't give you that extra oomph.
I think the biggest thing about this that worked for me is the main trio. I think it could have been something that, you know, the power of friendship and music, and isn't this all one, like, it could have been, you know, trite and overly sincere, and especially for, you know, a Netflix or a Sony movie, they have had those histories before, but then you realize this is also the same kind of Sony Netflix dynamic behind things like, you know, Mitchell's versus the Machines, even, you know, the team behind Cloudy with a Chance of Meatballs or Lego Movie, like these really overly zany kind of comedies that are legitimately funny, but have great relationships at their center. And I was really impressed by that main trio and what they are able to bring here, specifically Arden Cho, who I think gets the most here, which leads into one of my negatives maybe later on. But I love just any moment that the movie gets to sit with those three and just deal with the things that they do on stage, off stage. I think that is the thing that people are connecting to the most, and the thing that I found the most agreeable, for lack of a better word, the thing that took me beyond any of the glitz and glamour. And there is a lot that I want to get to on that. But I think just at that center, I think that's the thing that hooked me the most.
They're all such like lovable characters on their own, and then you put them all together and see like the ways that they interact with each other and like you know the course of their friendship like as the movie goes on, the way that they like make up at the end, like all of that I think it really is like the heart of the movie.
And then beyond that, there is the K-pop spectacle of it, which, oh my God, this movie looks so good. This movie looks so good. Like, I have to commend every animator, every character designer, every, color designer on the, like, the way that just the ways alone that like gold and pink are contrasted in the movie, like those colors alone, and then you add in, like the whites of the character outfits or like all the pastels that like the boy band wind up wearing. It's such a colorful explosion of a kind of, but it never becomes overbearing, except maybe for like one or two bits towards the end. But like even then, you're kind of awestruck by what they are able to do with the idea of like special effects and performance art and all of that tying in. And it does tie into the characters. There is this thing of, I know there is an aspect in K-pop of the idea of going bigger, embracing fan expectations. And I think the movie, again, I can't speak from the community level, but I can, as an audience member, I was certainly impressed by that idea to go bigger, go bolder in terms of the story and the stakes, while not making it feel overbearing or try hard.
Can we talk about the choreography? Because both the
And
dance choreography and the fight scene choreography were insane.
yes. Like we can talk about the songs probably in a minute, but like the opening scene is so well framed and well shot between. I just think of like the moment where like the song cuts to a break and you see like these very stagnated images, like the demons on the plane like breaking off, and then you pan like two other demons and they're panning off in a different way, and then you see the group like looking at the carcass of their plane in just shock and awe, and the way that that is blocked between shot to shot to shot is so frantic, but again, it doesn't feel overwhelming at any point.
Yeah, I think that was the moment in that movie where I was like, oh, okay. Because, you know, at first, like, it's a little silly with them eating all the food and
Yes.
stuff. And, like, I didn't really know what to expect. And then I saw that scene, heard that song, and was like, okay, cool. And then skipping ahead a little bit, but when you find out that Rumi has patterns, that's when I was like, wait a minute, what is going on here?
Like we have drama now.
I just think this movie was like, starts out like, oh, okay, and then like it just really shocks you. It's just so surprising, like how good it is.
I think the humor aspect is again the biggest surprise of the movie. I again going back to like the Mitchells versus the Machines idea, where like yes, on paper it is, that movie is a really important family drama about like the messiness of growing old and those dynamics about families and even AI and things like that. But it is also laugh out loud hilarious, like the jokes you can count per minute on both hands. And this is kind of the same way. We're just like even the thing with like Daniel Dae Kim as like the tonic expert. I was laughing myself silly. The stuff with the I don't know if they call the creature the name, the kind of weird blue tiger and the
Yeah,
magpie.
where he keeps knocking over
Every
the.
single bit with the can, I was laughing stupid. And there were just little things like that throughout where they're like, let's make a joke out of this, but not at the character's expense. And it just keeps happening over and over again.
Yeah, the jokes really were so good. I personally like always think of like the when they introduce the band and they do that like ooh thing and then they just like keep doing that.
Like the
When they
initial
introduce like
introduction?
the demon when they introduce like the Saja boys like and
Oh
they're
yes,
like
yeah.
yeah and they just do the ooh.
Which I will say that it leads into like one of my negatives a little bit, where that whole Saja Boy sequence is, exactly what it needs to be, and that ties in the songs, which I'm sure we'll get into in a second. But for me, like one of the things that I think I wanted more from, or that I think the movie maybe is a detriment to the movie, is that it really is mostly around Rumi and the main guy from the Soulja Boys. And I don't mind that on that character level. And they do try to give the girls specifically a bit more. The other Soulja Boys are very much afterthoughts. Like, they maybe have 4 lines in the entire movie each. They're not really meant to be care. And that is part of the appeal of how that boy band is set up. But it is one of the things where I kept thinking throughout of like, this movie's only 1 hour 40. You could add time to this if you want. I have heard that there was some kind of either rush production or that there were scenes left on the floor. I'm not sure which is which, but I would totally believe that idea because it seems like there is a lot more they could be doing with certain characters that the movie either doesn't have time to do or doesn't have interest in doing. And I want to give them the benefit of the doubt, but it was one of the things that kept rubbing me the wrong way of like, if this is about group dynamics, let's embrace that.
Yeah, that is totally fair. Not focusing on the other Saja boys doesn't necessarily bother me. I will say that, like, I think we could have gotten a little bit more from Mira and Zoe. But
Yes.
as far as time and what they didn't go into, the main thing that I wish they had talked more about is Rumi's parents, because we know that
Yeah.
her father was a demon, we know that her mother was a demon hunter. How exactly did that work? Does her mom dying have anything to do with the fact that her dad was a demon? And maybe that's something that we'll find out in these like sequels that we're supposed to get. I really don't know. But that's something that I wish that they had discussed more because it's such an interesting idea and I kept waiting for it to come into play more and it really didn't.
And then you know what? I think I'll be forgiving of the movie on that level. Like, that is something that I very much would want to see explored in a sequel, or I wish we had gotten a little bit here. The only reason I will push against that is the kind of parallel between, again, Rumi and Jinu is I think the idea of both of them feeling as if on some level they have failed their family's legacy. Like, you see from Rumi at certain points, pride in being a demon is a strong term, but the idea of figuring out who she is and how much she wants to embrace of that side of her versus Jinu, who is the idea of just wanting to forget and just delete that idea of himself. I think that idea and that parallel, I think, puts at arm's length the idea of, okay, maybe we don't have to see, like, again, even with Jinu's family, like, we never see like a real scene with his mom or his sister. They're always just kind of in the background, which that I would like to see in a sequel. I think that's a fascinating idea. But I think purely on a character parallel, I think the movie does just enough to put that idea at, okay, we don't need that.
I'm glad that you mentioned the idea of like embracing the parts of you that you're ashamed of versus trying to push them away. Because as a psychologist in training, that is one of the things I absolutely adored about this movie.
I was curious.
And I don't know if they were like trying to make a parallel to mental health or not, but the idea of like Guima being like in their heads, constantly telling them that they're not good enough. And if you try to push those voices away, it really doesn't work. But if you just embrace those parts of you, then, that's how they're able to save the Hanmoon, is embracing the parts of them that like they don't like. And like the lines in like what it sounds like, I should have let the jagged edges meet the light instead. I'm seeing all the beauty in the broken glass. All of that stuff I absolutely adored, and I love that ultimately that is also like what sets Jinu free, is being able to just let those, not like push them away, but kind of just like let those things be and accept like all of his faults.
Oh, yeah. The amount of readings I've seen where it's about mental health, or it's about queer identity, or it's about biracial identity, like the
There's
idea.
so many things that you can connect this to, and I think that that is like one of the great things about this movie is like you can like really glean from it whatever makes the most sense to you and whatever you find the most relatable.
Yes, and in a movie that is progressively seemingly getting bigger and bigger and bigger, at least in terms of the visuals and somewhat in terms of the story. I think that is one of the world building things that I will critique it a little bit for. Like, Guima is great. I love that Byung-Hun Lee is in this. Anything he's in, I will totally watch. I love just kind of the kind of sardonic bits of humor that he gets of like, huh, soda pop. That's clever. That's fun. Some of the ideas of demons and the double entendre of that, of like literal demons and internal demons, I think the idea of reflecting of, because for most of the movie, it is the idea of like, yeah, Jinu's good, but like the rest of these guys are like period. Like, there's even the bit where like, halfway through, Rumi's trying to figure things out, and she's attacking one of the demons. It's like, oh, is Guima doing this to you? And he kind of smiles and then just kills the guy. And I thought that was very interesting of the idea of no, like it, we're pretty much establishing of like, yeah, Gino's a good guy, but like the rest of these are like pure evil mwahaha demons. And I think that idea could have very much been explored upon of the idea of how much influence Guima actually has and what demons in this movie are supposed to literally represent.
Wonder if that's again something that like they might kind of like touch on more with a sequel, especially because again we do know that Rumi's dad was a demon. So are there other demons that are kind of similar to Ginyu? How did that work out?
There's also the idea of we haven't talked about Celine, voiced by Yeonjun Kim, who's Rumi's surrogate mom, who I think is maybe the most interesting character in the movie who doesn't get explored. Like, she is essentially in the beginning, she has a very pivotal scene towards like the end point, and that's kind of it. And she probably should be a more important character. Again, we have bigger fish to fry, like Mira and Zoe, for as fun of characters as they are. I feel like the movie kind of throws in towards the third act of like, yes, these are characters who have messy backgrounds who we should probably get into. And that's the bigger concern that we should be exploring. But like, Celine is the one character where I'm looking over there of like, shouldn't you be more important than you are?
I really would have liked just one scene at the end with Rumi and Celine because you have that part where like Rumi's like, "Why won't you look at me?" And like I would have loved to have some kind of resolution to that, but they just kind of leave it there.
Very much so. Really quickly, moving on to the songs. Again, I am not a K-pop head. These really do sound emblematic of like what we're hearing out of mainstream K-pop nowadays.
I am so sure that this is going to be my number one album on Spotify this year. I cannot stop listening to it. It's stuck in my head all the time. I see the songs everywhere, and I do absolutely love them. I mean, all of them worked for me, honestly, in different ways. I think they're all bangers, and Your Idol is actually crazy. I was not expecting that one bit. Something like Your Idol. I think it's so interesting when you listen to the lyrics and like the like, you know, it's like I could see how this is just like a boy band song, but also they're literally like, you know, it's like it could be metaphorical, like, oh, like you gave me your heart, now I'm here for your soul. But no, they really mean that. I think that that was really cool. I'm the only one who love your sins, that kind of stuff. But then also followed up by What It Sounds Like. I think that is absolutely something that moves the story forward. Like, again, like listening to those lyrics, that really kind of is like the like point of the whole movie. Like you again, like you can't just ignore the thing that makes the mistakes that you've made or like the, you know, like negative emotions you have or whatever. But you can like keep going on with your life despite those things because those are also part of you. I absolutely loved the music and I am really interested to hear what you have to say because you know much more about music than I do.
Look, I will start with What It Sounds Like because I really love the mixing on that song. Like, even j I just keep going back to that weird minor key vocal harmony at the very beginning when they're all walking on stage. I just keep thinking about, I think someone in the cast was like, oh, that was like our Imogen Poots song. And I was like, our Imogen Poots, Imogen Heap. Imogen Poots is the actress. Yes, our like Imogen Heap movement. And I was like, yeah, that's gorgeous and it works. And it's, you know, kind of the sparks coming back together to form the fire thing. And it totally works. I think also maybe represents the movie's appeal towards pop music more than anything, because I, again, this is not necessarily what I think, but certainly there, I have found people who look at K-pop as like the most saturated, condensed form of pop music nowadays. Like the thing of like, it's all big, all everything. If you don't like it, get out of the way. And I think What It Sounds Like more than any other song, even if it's, you know, maybe a bit too overwhelmingly, you know, sincere at points, but like the idea of pop music being the great unifier, literally in this movie, the thing that like brings all of their souls back into their bodies and, you know, unites everyone in friendship and fun and excitement. And I think I really would give the movie a lot of credit for that idea of, yeah, this is, you know, kind of big, silly pop music where if you look at the lyrics, it's a lot of platitudes. And even I love the fact that you get to see them writing the songs and the idea of like, yes, the if you read this out loud, you would be thinking, yeah, I don't, at least for me as a songwriter, like I would never write lyrics like this. But I love getting to see in their characters' eyes the idea of like, no, like this is what we want to talk about and this is how we're going to write it. And I love that notion of it. As far as the songs themselves, aside from that, Golden is really good. Golden
Oh
is really
yeah,
good.
Golden is phenomenal.
Soda Pop annoys the heck out of me, but that's by design.
It's just such a perfect boy band song. I
It
think that is
is.
like, it's so, you know, I love a good boy band. It's so cheesy and just perfect.
It and in the context of the scene itself is so, again, just like snap whiz bang kind of animated that you almost can't help but be the crowd in that moment of just like, oh wow, this is so fun. I don't remember strategy at all. Your Idol again has some really cool lyrical ideas to it. I think just some of the production kind of annoys me. Same thing with Takedown, frankly, which I think could be interesting, but again, by design, it's not meant to be complete necessarily. And again, that opening song, I don't love some of those like synth horn accents. I've never liked that sound in pop music. But the actual song itself is pretty good. And the way it's again used in the beginning is just so good that I'm willing to forgive it.
How do you feel about Free?
Which one is free?
It's the one that Jinu and Rumi sing
Oh, the
when
duet,
it's just the
yes.
two of them. Yeah.
I'm gonna have to go back to that one because I think at first listen, I was like, yes, narratively this works. I don't know if it would be a song that I go back to. Like, I would go back to What It Sounds Like or Golden. I'm not sure yet if Free would be that case.
That is very
I think just partly just
interesting.
because I think just partly because to me, like, it no slouch on Andrew Choi. He is a very good vocalist. I don't know if his and EJ's voices meshed as nicely on the first time around as I would have wanted.
Understandable. Yeah, I think Free's underrated, honestly. I'm one of the like two Free stans in the world.
Is this
But
not like,
yeah,
is this not popular in the K-pop fandom then?
I guess not. I don't know. I feel like most people, I tell them Free's one of my favorites, and they're like, huh? But anyways, yeah, I do think that's really interesting. I feel like you might be the only person who didn't really vibe with all of the songs. But you also are not just the movie king, but the music king.
Yeah.
So I do respect your opinion, even if I don't agree.
I mean, I don't know if I would not wear both crowns, I would tell you that. But I think there's just the idea of this is a genre of music that I am coming at again from an arm's distance. And like there are going to be people who I know are going to love Takedown. I know at least one of you is listening. I know you love this song. Thank you for listening, by the way. We need to wrap this up, but I do want to quickly ask you, the theatrical run, which this did get a brief 2-day window out in LA and New York for awards consideration. So this is now going to be in Oscar conversations, thank God. And it also received about a weekend run of a sing-along release. I did not dare go to this, but it made $20 million in 2 days. I'm curious from your perspective, looking at between this, Glass Onion, and like a couple of other things in the last number of years, do you see this being the thing that breaks Netflix's we're not going to do theaters mentality? Or do you think this is very much just the anomaly of all anomalies?
You know, I really don't know, but I would hope so. Because I am honestly kind of concerned about like the fate of theaters, with streaming. And I mean, we've seen that like people will show up to the theater. And I didn't personally go to see that in theaters because I knew it was just going to be really expensive, and difficult to get tickets. But I would have loved to. I'm sure it was a really great experience seeing it in theaters, and I love that they did that. And yeah, I mean, I hope that this is like a sign for, the future, but I really don't know.
I hope so. Like, at least for me, like, even just this past weekend, like, we got the Thursday Murder Club, which we're probably going to talk about the show the following week. But that was apparently getting a theatrical release. I could not find anything in either Arizona. I found like one theater in Southern California that was showing it. So, like, Netflix, I wish would step up on that department. I understand why they're not, unless it is like Apple and F1, where like, no, like we shot this in IMAX. This is a huge and huge endorphin rush of a racing movie. Put this in theaters. But like this kind of has the same appeal to a lot of people, as we saw over literally a 48-hour period with the sing-along version, which again, I'm not sure I would have gone to. Like, imagine if you're going to see like Honey Don't or like any indie movie and you're just hearing Takedown blared from the next screen over. I don't know if I want that. But I really do hope that this gives Netflix some less hesitation to expand the theater. Glass Onion succeeded in part because people were able to go experience it on this level. And I really do hope that, again, I'm not expecting Netflix to go, gangbusters on theatrical releases on like 4,000 theaters for like a month. I'm not expecting that. But like, Put it in 600 theaters for 2 weeks. Like, you're gonna make your money back. It's proven that with the right property, you can. It's proven that, like you say, people will go to theaters if there's something really good out there. And I would argue August has been surprisingly good on that level so far. So yeah, I hope this is the thing that starts to break that monopoly.
If any animated movie is going to get Oscars, first of all, I hope it's a Spider-Verse movie, but if it's not going to be a Spider-Verse movie, I hope it's this one that starts to change the game at the Oscars for animation. I know you and me agree on this. We love animation.
Which
Animated
is
movies are constantly snubbed, and this has made such a huge impact that I just hope that it really changes the Oscars landscape. I don't think it will, but I hope.
funny because we keep talking about like, haha, Sony can't do things. And then we're like, no, Spider-Verse and K-pop Demon Hunters are kind of changing how we view American animation right now. Why shouldn't we be
Yes.
talking about that?
100%.
Do you think a animated feature and original song, at least one, are in its future?
It's gotta be at least one, right?
Yeah.
Like, there's no way that it's not gonna win at least one of those. With how much, like, with the critical success of this movie, there's just no way that they're gonna be snubbed. But then again, sometimes the Oscars really surprise us. I'm looking at you, Jamie Lee Curtis, instead of Stephanie Hsu or Viola Davis getting that best actor or best supporting actress Oscar. So you never know.
don't get me started on 2022 supporting actress. I will never stop talking about it. No, I would, again, I can't put money down right now because I'm not that foolish, but like it has to get a solid nomination. It
It's gotta have
has
at least
to.
something. It out a nomination, absolutely. Win, I feel like it's still gotta get at least one of those.
I would think so, because again, between this and Sinners and F1, like we're looking at a potentially, oh my God, after last year, I will take any original song category that we get this year. Like there
Oh
can't
yeah.
possibly be one worse than last year.
Yeah, 100%. But I'm also thinking now about how Oppenheimer didn't even make the short list for visual effects. So you really never
True.
know with the Oscars, but I just feel like there will be outrage if they don't at least get a nomination.
And this has, at least for the animation race, this is the people's champ. Like, by every stretch of the imagination, there is no animated movie this year, literally by numbers wise, from the fact that Red Notice has finally been defeated as the most popular Netflix movie because of this. But again, the idea of this being the movie that I remember like 2 or 3 weeks ago when this either came out or was starting to come out, and I started to hear like the murmurs of like, hey, K-pop Demon Hunters is really good. And I was like, is this like an Ultraman situation where like 10 people are going to watch it and won't stop shutting up about it? Like, I thought that's what it was going to be because that's how ignorant and stupid I am. And now we're 3 weeks later and it's the biggest thing in the world. And I just can't help but look at that and go, the Oscars have to keep that in mind. Like, again, maybe this doesn't win animated feature, but this is going to go a long way by the time we get into November and December.
Absolutely.
What is your rating for K-pop Demon Hunters?
I gotta give it a 9, honestly. I thought this film was really well made. There are some things that I wish they had expanded on a little bit more. But overall, I think it was a great movie, and I've seen it 3 times at this point, and I absolutely love it.
I fully intend to see it again because I think there are going to be things sitting with it that I'm going to like more upon re as the fandom has said in droves, but I think sitting with these characters and with these songs and again with the animation that I cannot stress enough is maybe just worth the time to sit down as it is. 8.5. It's really good. There are things about it that I really love. I love again the camaraderie between the characters. I love the humor. I love the animation. I love the ideas that are again there if you look. And the appreciation for that level of pop music community that I think could be so cynical or so overwhelmingly, overly sincere, if you want to look at it that way. There are things that I wish did differently. I wish, again, that the group dynamics were handled a bit better. I wish the mythology was maybe a bit more solidified because I kind of brushed over this point, but a lot of the times in the back of my head, I just kept thinking, like, is this just made for music videos? Which is a horrible thing to be thinking, and it is a very good narrative and a great story. But I did keep thinking sometimes, again, with like the free duet or like some of the earlier songs, where I kept thinking, like, is this just an excuse to do cool animation over cool music and make that to the end of the day? But it is. There is so much more to this, and I won't say I completely get why it has taken over the world, but there are so many reasons why, if you're again someone like me who is not a total K-pop stan, to give this a chance. Like, there are a lot of great things there.
Would recommend that anyone just give it a try. Even if you are not into K-pop, if you're not really into animation, If you hear the title and you're like, what the hell is that? Just give it a shot.
Episode 53 is in the books. Thank you so much for tuning in. Good time. Fun was had by all. Special thanks to Danielle Bogenkamp for joining us on this episode. If you like the show, Spotify, Apple Podcasts, RSS feed, at Plot Devices. Follow the show on Twitter, Instagram, and very soon Blue Sky, at Plot Devices Pod. Give us a rating and a comment if you can, and either on socials or the show itself. Again, the discussion question from the top of the show is, what is your favorite adaptation of Frankenstein? Comment below or on our socials. We'd love to hear it, and we'll hopefully get a chance to read some of those responses next week. If you want to follow any of my misadventures for whatever reason, Twitter, Instagram, I'm on there at TheMovieKing45. Blue Sky, I'm also on there at BDK45.BSKY.social. And remember, tickets for Nick Noodle and the Angel Hairs. We are live at Rebel Lounge in Phoenix Tuesday, September 9th. Yours truly on drum duties. It's going to be a great time. Link for that show and all of the other stuff we've talked about in our description. Episode 54 coming up next week as we head into September. Have a great Labor Day weekend if you can. For Plot Devices, I'm Brandon King. See you around.